My name is Jenny, and I actually am a biogeochemist. I've done my polar work in the dry valleys of Antarctica with Mike Musso, who was supposed to be here today, but couldn't make it, unfortunately. But I'm also a co-PI on a grant with Brecken and Elena to study thermokarst in Alaska, and so that's why we're kind of here to explain a little bit about that program as well, because we've got a number of grad student opportunities and things like that that are coming up, so this would be a good opportunity to tell you guys all about that. But first, let me give you a little background on APEX and just list some of the new things that are coming up. So my first polar experience was somewhat of a fluke. I was actually working on acid mine drainage for my PhD, and that's some of the most contaminated stuff you can deal with. And I was lucky enough to have a course from Diane McKnight, and she had an opportunity for somebody to go. And so I went to Antarctica and completely changed my course of study. And at the same time, I was in the dry valleys in a tent with a teacher, Louise Huffman, who some of you might know. And I was introduced to education and outreach and realized how powerful of a tool that can be, not just for having people learn about your science, but for having me be able to explain and understand my own science. You really start to learn how to understand what you're doing a little bit better, I think, when you're explaining it to other people. So through all of that, we got both Louise and I got involved with Rhianne in the International Polar Year, and realized that there was a need for something for young scientists and for us to be able to be connected to the IPY, because there were so many graduate opportunities that were coming up because of all these funding opportunities and things. So that's sort of how APEX was born. We're officially a little over a year old. We formed a council and an executive committee last year in Stockholm, Sweden. And that meeting was funded by a company that makes recycled toilet paper, which I always love to say because we'll take money from anywhere. So after my graduate work, I did a postdoc in the dry valleys, and then I was a professor for a year and realized I didn't like doing that, and then went to Fairbanks for a while. And now, and during that whole time, I was working with a great group of people to create APEX, and was doing a lot of that as a volunteer, which many of you in this room are active doing that stuff as well. And we are very fortunate now to have the Norwegian Research Council and the University of Tromsø to fund my salary for the next 3 years to help coordinate these types of things and to make more opportunities happen for you guys. So it's a great resource, and please be sure to use me as much as you can. But some of the neat things that are coming up, so we tend to do a lot of these types of smaller panels just to have people meet each other, and especially at a big conference like this, I think it's important for us to be able to recognize people. So when you're walking around the poster hall and you don't know anybody, you've got a person that you can talk with, and also to connect with the senior researchers and to really have this continuum of knowledge and leadership and sharing and forming some partnerships. So we do one every year here at AGU. We have one at the Arctic Science Summit Week that is coming up in Bergen, Norway, the end of March. The deadline for abstracts for that conference has been extended, as has the deadline for travel fellowships for young researchers. So I encourage all of you to apply for those travel fellowships, because they're they don't have enough applicants right now. So
when is it?
It's the end of March. The deadline is middle of January. And I can give you all that. Arctic Science Summit Week.
What's that meeting?
This is the first year that it's actually going to be a science conference, so it's 3 days of science things, and then on the side of that, there are lots of different side meetings. So the Arctic Ocean Sciences Board, for example, meets. The Pacific Action Group, which is studying the Pacific Arctic Ocean, meets, and some of these other areas, as well as IASC, the International Arctic Science Committee, which does a lot of international coordination of science and things in there. They're all really great people and super supportive of young researchers, so I highly encourage you to take advantage of those scholarships to meet with those people. We're also having a panel at the Gordon Conference on Polar Marine Sciences in Italy, and there are some travel funding opportunities available for that as well. All this information is on the APEX website. If you can't find it, just send me an email. We're having APEX has partnered with UNIS on Svalbard to have an international interdisciplinary summer school in the end of June and July, and that's another fully funded program, so keep your eyes out for that. We're working with IARC, the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and we're putting together a field school for 21 days at Bellingshausen, which is the Russian base on the Antarctic Peninsula, and that one will be fully funded as well, so keep your eyes peeled for those things. We're having another panel discussion like this at Oslo, the American Society of Limnology and Oceanography. If any of you go to that, keep your eyes open for that one. A number of other things. And then we're also having a large international student conference in Whitehorse, Canada, together with ACUNS, the Association of Canadian Universities of Northern Studies. Lots of acronyms here, by the way. And that will be in October, and that should be fully funded as well for people to come. And that conference is 2 days of science talks and presentations, as well as a day of career development and opportunities and ways to learn more about some of the new research stations that are being built and some of the new opportunities that are coming down the pipe as a result of IPY. And the other thing I'm supposed to mention is that SCAR, the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research, is having a biology symposium in Japan this summer. And the U.S. was just informed that they have 7 travel fellowships available for young researchers, and only one person has applied. So I think that's another great opportunity for you guys to check out. And again, I have all this information if you want. So those are some of the things that we're doing. And how these things come to be is somebody usually says, I'm going to this conference. Are there any other APEX members going? And so we help to make that happen, to contact the organizers of the conferences and to get a room and get things like that. It's very grassroots and organic kind of thing. So it's really easy. So if there are other conferences that you guys are going to and you'd like to, you know, do something even as simple as sending out an email saying, let's meet at this bar this night, it can be really easy, but it helps to bring people together. Some of the projects that we're working on, we're developing a field school network. So there's all these field schools that are happening both in the Arctic and the Antarctic, but sometimes it's hard to know about them and keep them all together. So if you know of any field schools, please let us know. We're putting all that information into a Google Earth layer and developing a discussion forum so that everybody can share the information they learn from one field school to the other. So that's a new initiative undertaken by a polar law student, actually, in Iceland, so that's great. Santanu and I are working on a new project for APEX that I think will be really great, a virtual poster session. So everybody walks through these hallways, and you see all these posters that are sitting there, and when you go home, they sit on your computer, and you never do anything with them again. So you'll be able to upload the poster as well as your abstract and some keywords and anything else you want people to know. All of it will be searchable, including the actual PDF of your poster as well, so people will be able to find you. We're going to organize them into some type of sessions. We haven't figured that part out yet, so if there's any ideas, that'd be great. And then we're going to have a once-a-month phone call to highlight 5 to 10 of these posters, and anybody can join this phone call. And we'll record the 2 minutes of somebody explaining their poster, and then have a discussion at the end. And then those little recordings of the 2 minutes will be attached to your poster. So if somebody comes on and looks at your poster again in the future, they could actually listen to you explaining your research. So we're hoping that will help to start some research dialogue going. We are putting together a research activities committee, which basically allows us to have point people in different disciplines or different areas of focus to help share information from one discipline to another. So if there's somebody in here who's interested in physical oceanography, perhaps, and you subscribe to 7 or 8, listservs, it'd be great for us to know what those listservs were so that we can share all the information with all the other members and to continue those types of dialogues. So, those are the basic things. We've got a few other things kind of in the hopper, but they're not ready to be talked about yet. So, any questions on any of that stuff? Yeah.
So you mentioned Bellingshausen. Mm-hmm. When was that?
That's in January 2010.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is that an APEX organized?
APEX and IARC, yeah, together on the Russian base. And so the reason why we're doing it, one of the reasons we're doing it at Bellingshausen is because, you might be interested in listening too.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively inexpensive to do it there, basically. Yeah. But the other good part is that it's on the Antarctic Peninsula on King George Island, which is very close proximity to a lot of other national bases. So what we're going to do is we're going to be visiting all these different bases so that the young scientists can experience these other bases and learn about the logistics and the science that are going on at that, so that really can help you make international collaborations very early in your careers. So
people can take their own science on that trip.
Yep, absolutely. So that one will be like a week and a half of lectures at in-the-field training, so you'll actually go out and do a permafrost borehole and things like that, as well as then 2 weeks to do some preliminary research projects and things. And we have a woman from the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry coming along to do some education and outreach and to broadcast this back to a bunch of different science museums and things like that. So there's a lot of stuff that's happening with that one coming up. So now I think maybe we'll turn it over for a little discussion, question, answer thing. So one of the, we brought Elena and Breck here today just to kind of give us a little experience on what they've done and kind of any advice that they might have. So, Santino, do you want to?
First of all, I would like to say thank you to everybody coming to this session. And I mean, I guess we are really fortunate to have this diverse group of people in the same room. It's just like the polar science. And as early career scientists, we are always interested in talking to like, our senior like scientists, and we want to know you know, how they got involved and who they are. And today we are very fortunate to have two of our senior scientists, Alan Asper from UAF and Brett Borden from University of Vermont. And I guess first I would request you know, you guys to go and talk about who you are, how you got involved, and then probably you can open up the session for discussions. So first I'd like to request you, Alan, if you can go ahead.
Okay. I was hoping that Brett would go first.
ladies first.
Actually, 1 second. I think two new people walked in. Masha, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Masha Tsukernik, and I can't believe that Apex is just 1 year old, because I've been going to this meetings for at least 2 or 3. I'm a postdoc now at National Center for Atmospheric Research, but I was a grad student for a while. And it's been really great for what Apex has been doing, because I found a lot of new opportunities that I actually attended. So thanks.
Yeah, I'm Eleonora Strada. I come from Italy. I've just subscribed as an Apex member. I think it's 3 months ago or something like that. I was involved last year in the drilling season in the SMS Android project. And so I joined a bit late. Sorry for the delay. And I'm happy to be here with you.
Great. Sorry. Okay. So you want a brief?
Yeah, just kind of give us a history of your, well, and then the advice you have.
Right. Okay. I guess one of the advice is be open to all kinds of opportunities that open up to you, and don't be, you know, kind of stuck in one thing. Welcome the opportunities that may come your way might not be the same one that you had, the same trajectory that you were trying to follow. Well, one of the things I have, I guess I owe it to my mother, who has always said, I do not have anything to give you. And I went to the United States for my graduate studies, my master's in soil microbiology agronomy at Cornell University, and then my PhD at Colorado State University. And that was also, well, I got 2 degrees there. I got an MRS. I got married there. So, and I'm still working on that degree. We also have two children. So that affected the trajectory of my professional growth. But So I went from doing research. I worked for the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, and then now I'm the International Arctic Research Center. So quite different. And so I was doing soil microbiology, soil chemistry work, and then went into and through my PhD. But then in the work, I had to have, there was a lab there because I had to deal with children growing up. And so I took, you know, part-time jobs, and some of them not very well suited to what I was, you know. I even went to coloring maps for survey project, but then got back into doing microbiology work with federal agency, US EPA and then USDA. And then when I when that station closed down in Fairbanks, USDA Subarctic Research Station, I was starting, we were doing climate change work, and I was also starting to be going into education outreach. And so it was a choice, you know, between going the education outreach route and or going the research route. And I started with education outreach first and then ended up actually being able to do both. And so, and it is by working with teachers, K-12 teachers and students in their classrooms to engage them in environmental research and earth system science research. And I have learned a lot, not just from scientists, but a great deal from K-12 teachers who have a lot to offer us in terms of communicating our science, communicating with diverse audiences, and then, of course, when IPY came along, I have been supporting my work with writing grant proposals, and that was one of the reasons that I didn't want to go on a tenure track position, because I said I don't want to have to write grants. You know, I've been forced to write grants, but then I ended up doing it. But I liked it because it was my choice. And so I've been able to fund both my education outreach and research with grants. So my advice is, I guess, you know, be open. And one of the things that energized me was being able to share my science with teachers and students, because they really, I mean, they get very excited working with scientists, and our children were one of our teachers too, because then they would say, well, why don't you just say it this way, you know, because I start expounding on, you know, what microbiology is and stuff and explain that, and then I realized that I had to make it understandable. That was appropriate, you know, AIDS appropriate level, and so our children were part of our teacher, my teacher, as doing education outreach.
Perhaps like Elena, I had no intention of having a career in Arctic science when I started out. And I'd really like to echo something that Elena said as being central of keeping an open mind about what is available to you. And actually, the way I'd like to express it is in thinking about serendipity in life. And that may sound like a staggeringly unplanned way for you to progress through your career, but I'd argue that it's an extremely fun and interesting way. What I mean by that is that I can't possibly know tomorrow what opportunity is going to come up. I don't have a crystal ball any better than anybody else does about what new opportunity might come up tomorrow. And they always do. But if you have some search and if you have some search image for the things that interest you personally, then when that opportunity serendipitously comes up, you can say, well, that kind of fits my model, or it doesn't, and you can either act on it or set it aside. So it's not exactly a random walk, but it is. And some people might think that it's a fairly unstructured way to approach your life, but I find that, at least for me, it was a very exciting, fruitful, rewarding way for me to lead my life. I could not have possibly known at one point in my life that somebody was going to call me up and ask, as I was sitting in the University of New Hampshire at the time, how would I like to move to New Zealand and work in New Zealand full time. Couldn't have possibly predicted that. I had to leave everything, of course, except my family. I brought them along, and they were willing to do so, which is an amazing and wonderful thing. That experience opened up whole new doors for me. Not just meeting people, but ideas, being able to think about things differently. I then, 5 years later, couldn't have possibly known that I'd be offered the position that I currently hold at the University of Vermont, and that would open the doors that it opened. So you can't predict these things, and I don't think you should worry about the fact that you can't predict these things. Serendipitously, opportunities will come up, and you can weigh how they fit into your search image or not. Now, my own trajectory was I started out as I got degrees in chemistry and I forgot what I got my degrees in. Chemistry and physics. No, that's not right. Chemistry and zoology. That's it. Chemistry and zoology from the University of Georgia, and then I went on to North Carolina State to work on coastal ecosystems, coastal ecology, with a fellow named John Hobby. Now, I don't know how many of you know John Hobby, but he's well-known for his work in the Arctic. But when I met him and was working with him, it was to do completely different things. It was to work on coastal wetlands. John liked the work that I did as a master's student, and so when John made the transition back in the 1970s, now I'm going to date myself, to start the Ecosystem Center at the Woods Hole, at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, he invited me to come along with him and work on a PhD program. Again, still not working on Arctic systems. Did a PhD with John, and then moved elsewhere, accepted a position at the University of New Hampshire. And it was at that point that John finally asked me if I would have some interest in starting to work on the new Arctic LTER program at Tulip Lake. And I jumped at that chance as one of those serendipitous opportunities I couldn't have possibly predicted. At that time, I was doing trace gas emissions from northern forest lands decided that this was a terrific opportunity. And it has been. It's been incredibly enriching. I was asked to think about stream ecosystems in the Arctic and primary productivity and nutrient dynamics, which is what I did for the first number of years, the first 10 years or so, and continue to do. But the opportunity to work there allowed me to work with other people who stimulated my thinking, allowed me to see things that I would not have seen before, to think about Arctic systems, and I'm now... I had the great good fortune very recently to be working with a large team of colleagues, including Elena and Jenny and Mike Gusev, who I will tell you sends his apologies. He got flu last night at dinner, which I was having with him. So he says it was best that he not be here, but he's sorry that he can't. A large team of colleagues to look at the influences of thermokarst on the Arctic landscape, and we're very excited about this. I'm going to be working with people who are going to stimulate my thinking even further, and that's what I think is exciting about this. I'll stop there.
And actually, we're very fortunate to have probably one of the busiest men I've ever met, and this is Dave Carlson. He's the director of the International Program Office for IPY. Dave, if you want to maybe introduce yourself, give a little history of your career path, because it is also serendipitous, I think. Mm-hmm. And any advice you have?
Checkered is the word.
And any advice you have?
No, I also, if I can, an OPEX event. I think that OPEX energy and excitement, whether it's formal or informal, is one of the most positive things that's happened in IPY, and I hope you feel that way as well. I hope you feel that it's good for your career and good for science. As Jenny knows, I sell it hard in almost every presentation, and it's widely perceived as a great success. So I congratulate you because you're, in a small way, in Barack Obama's shoes. Everyone has great expectations for you in the future. So that's, otherwise, other than that, the future is good. If you've heard my recent presentations, you know that I'm sounding two other themes. One is the need to keep feeding climate-related science to this hungry crowd of international teachers. And boy, we've got them. They're hungry. They're engaged. Elena and I were in a meeting this morning with, 45 or 50? They're not getting it. They're not getting what they want. both for their classroom and their own personal satisfaction. They're not getting it from the academic system, from the educational system. But the place they can get it is from young scientists. It's not easy to go into those classrooms. There's things you can do to learn how to make that a more comfortable experience. But talking to those teachers, involving them in your research, I mean, all of you are going to write NSF proposals, or many of you, and a connection with the teacher is not only a fun and engaging way to do that, but you'll learn a lot by learning about it. So that's one theme I'm sounding is we have excited a group of international teachers, and the way to keep them connected to current science is through young researchers. Second, the theme I'm sounding, which probably is on your minds as well, is, and this is stimulated by meeting Quebec City last week. Who was there in Quebec? Arctic ASA, Arctic Net Student Association. 400 students, all excited about polar research, Canada. It was fabulous. You would have loved it. You would have felt right home. Where are they going to get jobs? There are 400 students and 200 postdocs and X times countries. Where are they going to get jobs? There is, demographics are in your favor. There are changeover. Rand knows I call them the white beards, like me, or the gray beards. There is quite a lot of changeover, and there is sinking money. But when I'm starting to talk to the, and Jenny's seen the documents I'm writing, when I talk to polar institutions, big polar institutions and polar programs, Danish Polar Committee, Canadian Polar Committee, national committees, which I'm at all every week, I'm saying, you've got to be planning for the future work path and career needs of this crop of young, excited students and postdocs, because it would be a complete failure if we get everyone excited and then we have no more than we had before. And I'm actually optimistic about that, but the reason I'm speaking about it is because that won't happen overnight, and organizations have to start planning about that. My career, I grew up in the center of the U.S. and got excited about the ocean through things like Jacques Cousteau. The ocean was the next frontier. And loved oceanography for the fact that I could do interdisciplinary. I published in physical oceanography. We published some of the first uses of genetic material to understand the microbiology of the ocean. I published in chemical oceanography. And that's why I would call that a checkered career, because you would look at that. I had 3 papers in Nature in my first 5 years. So you would say, you know, that's a. But if you said, did I develop a 10-year program in chemical oceanography so that I was the premier chemical oceanographer? No, I didn't do that. I published in 11 places. And as you said, it was because I found interesting colleagues in zoology and in soil science. So I followed my ideas a lot. And was able to write the proposals to support them. I had a feeling after about 8 or 9 years of that, with the sense of climate change, that I wasn't doing enough. That putting another publication, whether it was in Nature or JPO or whatever, on the shelf wasn't enough. So I moved into science management. I led the program TOGA, Tropical Ocean Global Atmosphere. So I started in the tropics. And at the end of that, I sort of did an assessment. I said 2 things. I said to my wife, I'll never do that again. It's too much work. Second, I sort of made a personal assessment of how much science did I assist and help as opposed to having done it myself. And it was sort of a positive balance. For a decade, then I worked for the National Science Foundation and NCAR in atmospheric science. So I got a complete set of training in cloud physics, large-scale dynamics, hydrology, climate, and it was hard work. It was line management. It was annual budgets and personnel and 125 employees and all that. But I also felt that I was learning every day, which I heard you just say, and that I was helping other people do good science. And this program came along, and it just seemed like just the right time. Who had done more in program management than I had. I wasn't a polar researcher, although I did polar oceanography early in my career, and been an amazing ride. Just unbelievable. You can't know the global enthusiasm for this project. We've met the queens, we've met the kings, we've had dinners in castles, we've had dinners on ships, we've had parliamentarians, ministers, especially in the U.S., I don't think you sense the international excitement for this, and the young researchers around the world who are your future colleagues. So it's, from where we sit, I'm sure Rhiannon would say that, and Jen, other people see it. It's amazing, the international enthusiasm for this. Just astounding. And so to come back to where I started, one of the proudest things that we have to show for IPWA is OPEX and the enthusiasm of young researchers.
Well, I feel motivated. So does anybody have any questions?
I do have to run, so...
You had a good question for me before.
Sorry, I forgot your name. You wanted to...
I'm Ryan Banta. I was just talking to Jenny earlier about writing NSF grants and the difficulties. I'm at a soft money institution, so I'm 100% grant funded, which is a joy in today's economy. And consequently, writing an NSF proposal proves to be a little bit difficult because I'm breaking into a new field, or I should say I'm new to breaking into the field, being a postdoc. And if you had any tips as to not only how to write or the things to focus on an NSF grant, but where to go other than NSF, because NSF's running out of money fast.
Yeah. Are there NSF program managers in the room?
They're hoping to stop by later.
Good. I don't want them to hear what I'm about to say. I was soft-funded. I had 30% hard and lived on soft. That was a time in oceanography when ONR was putting a lot of money into especially upper ocean trace metals and stuff, and that all went away. And so there was increasing pressure on NSF. You've got to know a program manager personally. They've got to know you. And the best way to do that is to organize a workshop on this new topic that you're thinking about, because those program managers have startup money and planning money and little planning grants, and they don't have to go through big proposal review trigger. They can make a decision to help you fund a workshop, especially if you tie it to one of the strategic themes that you know, it doesn't have to be in geosciences, or it can be one of the NSF cross-cutting themes. So meet that person, meet them here, meet them somewhere, meet them when they come to visit your institution. Your institution has an outreach officer who knows the NSF public affairs. And when your dean or your so-and-so is going to go to a panel meeting, or your advisor is going to a panel meeting at NSF, have them give a talk. Have them give a talk on that topic, okay? Then you go to that program manager and you say, you know, I'm starting to hear this, and there's things we could do, but we'd sort of like to get together. Because what you're doing is it sounds like it's, you know, altruistic and idealistic. What you're actually doing is you're skipping their first step, because they're going to turn down your first proposal and they're going to come back to you and say, well, why didn't you do a workshop on this? And so what I'm telling you is jump the first step and get there. And then partly what you're doing is you're developing your ideas. You're getting NSF engaged, but you're also letting the review community of your proposal see you, hear you, learn what your ideas are. You know, that's for good or bad. That's your ability to... But the two strengths of that is, even though they may or may not say it, those program managers can approve a workshop ad hoc right off their desk. They don't have to go through a review. They don't have to. A nice way to do it is find someone else in your institution who's got a big NSF grant and make it a little planning workshop that's a tag off of that, because then the route to your institution is already open and you don't even have to open a new route to get that funding. They can make that decision. That way you start to build your ideas, find other young researchers, find mentors, whatever you want to do. They'll almost always, let's just say, your success rate for that is 50%, whereas your success rate on your first proposal is less than 10. So that's That's the thing. Other sources right now in the U.S. R&D, satellite validation is always a good option. Find your space institute or your space science. What's the equivalent of Sea Grant? Space Grant? Is there a space grant? There's a space grant program at your university somewhere. Figure out which platforms are not performing because of attenuation issues that are unique to the polar regions, and again, do a planning workshop or do some initial proposals. If you look at a lot of the university-based institutions that are based on space, hard space, building instruments, launching platforms, they also have lots of validation programs. Alaska has it, Wisconsin has it, UNH has it. Use that validation money to do a little bit that helps them and a little bit that helps you. So I don't know ONR right now. I just don't know what money is in ONR. I haven't followed it for a long time. But you got to figure that every agency is going to have tough years. Actually, I heard an interesting attitude. It'd be funny to know if others see. A NASA program manager stopped by, very high, a good friend of mine. He said, no, we're optimistic. Once the budget deficit in the U.S. bursts $1 trillion, a couple extra billion for science doesn't matter. So, you never know. But because you don't know which way it's going to go, you don't know whether the success rates are going to get tougher or better, you've got to be sort of putting yourself in position so whichever way the luck falls, your place. So take this workshop approach, find some satellite validation work that you can get connected to. I'm just not connected enough to the U.S. funding system to know where the other sources are right now.
Well, I agree with almost everything that Dave mentioned, so I'm not going to repeat that. I'll try to think of a couple of others here. I will tell you that I have never written a proposal by myself as a single person. All of the work I've done and anything I've done in any aspect of my career has been collaborative. I've always worked with other people and had the good fortune of having people who early in my career were mentors and then colleagues and then supporters as I was developing my work. And to a certain degree, science is like an old-fashioned apprentice system. You spend a period of time learning the tricks of the trade. Learning how to write proposals, learning how to present your ideas, learning how to work with others. And that was certainly my experience. I had the great, good, serendipitous fortune of meeting up with John Hobby early on. He was an accommodating mentor, taught me the various things that he thought were successful. I think everybody around the room knows that for an NSF proposal, the key criteria are intellectual merit and the broader impacts of the proposal. So first and foremost, a proposal has got to be something that's addressing something that is at the very forefront of advancing the intellectual content of what we know about the world. But increasingly, and this is, I think, quite relevant to this group, is the broader impacts component of that. That has gone from being a kind of a footnote to being an incredibly a make it or break it component of your proposal. So I encourage you, specifically with respect to NSF, but I believe that this is true of all of the agencies, that it's not something that's a second thought, that, as long as you have the science right, that you can just write something to fill in that paragraph there and you'll be okay. This is something that requires some considerate thought. With respect to additional sources of funds, it is tough at the moment. I do share Dave's optimism that it will get better after some gloomy periods here, I think, that we're about to face, but that it will get better. We cannot ignore the Arctic environment and what's happening there. It is too important to what's happening elsewhere globally. And so I anticipate that there will be new opportunities there, but I will say that I think it's going to be tough for a while just because it's going to be tough on everybody. Occasionally, there are programs that I see that come through USDA, for example. A year or so ago, there was a program in USDA on Arctic, Arctic systems. NOAA has had programs in the past, but and the satellite, NASA satellite areas for the, several of you I hear are interested in those areas, I think is another good source.
The other thing I was going to mention is that if you turn down once, that's not a new thing. Everybody has had at least one proposal turned down. And so be persistent. And also, even though it's a moving target, you know, the reviewers change every year. I mean, you know, you submit a proposal. And so, you know, sometimes they can be very not nice in what they say. And, you know, don't be discouraged because it's just a matter of, you know, taking the lumps and going at it again. And so, and saying about, you know, you wanting to go into a new field, well, the one that I had tried the first time was actually going into the education and human resources. And I'm a scientist and not an educator, and so they said it's very competitive. And so I teamed collaboratively with educators, and we had the idea of combining Western science with native knowledge. But it was the third time that we got funded. But, you know, at first, well, that was like 10 years ago. Now it's more acceptable that we do recognize and acknowledge the knowledge, different world perspectives. But before, people refused to say, refused to acknowledge that Native people were intelligent enough to and do science. And so my first title was, you know, combining Western science and Native science. Mm-mm, that was a big, you know, and so they said, well, give an example, the first panel said. So the second proposal was, so I said Native ways of knowing, and we gave an example, and they said, you have to take the spirituality out of this front, you know. And so we go, wait a minute, you know, we're in. So anyway, the third time, we changed the title and said Western science and Native observations. Observations, empirical. Anybody can make observations. And then we were able to bring in what we actually were wanting to do is acknowledge the anecdotal and historical and long-term knowledge, systemic science knowledge of Native people. So anyway, whether it's education or a new part of science, just don't be discouraged. You know, pick yourself up and.
I wonder if I might pick up on that, actually, Eleni. I think you said that it's not unusual for somebody, you know, for you to have had a proposal rejected. It's not unusual for you to have many proposals rejected repeatedly, all right? You got to have a pretty thick skin. I mean, you know, so that email shows up in your email box, you know, in your inbox, and you can see it's from the program manager from NSF or NASA, so what's in there, you know? And 9 times out of 10, it's sorry, okay? And that's just crushing. You know, you've put your intellect, your life into this proposal for some number of weeks. I mean, it's really crushing. And you got to just set that aside, walk away from that, put it in the not in the trash bin, put it in the reserve file, you know, for a week, a month, whatever it is, and then go back and carefully read those reviews. They're often harsh. There's folks out there who are, and you know, I'm a glass half full person, or at least I try to be. That you know, when people write reviews, they're not being purposely mean. You know, but they have a responsibility to be critical. There's a huge difference between constructive criticism and just being mean. You know, 99% of the people out there are reviewers, are not me, but they know that money's tight, it's got to be the best science, and I know personally that the hardest reviews I have to write are the ones for proposals that I know I'm going to have to decline, that it's just up to snuff. It's, if it's excellent, if it's just over-the-top excellent, I mean, I'm happy to just say excellent and send it back, because that's hardly, you know, don't have to justify it. But if there's problems, I struggle as a reviewer in you know, how I'm going to, in what I'm going to say, and to be sure that it's going to be guidance in the future. You're doing this with, you know, the 20 minutes of spare time you've got in your day, right? So just realize that folks are under a lot of pressure, and they are trying to be constructively critical. You now need to actually look at those comments. What is this person actually saying? Sometimes that requires looking between the lines a little bit, but take to heart what they're saying. Now, it gets worse. So, and I'm going to pick up on something else that Elena said. She said that she tried three different titles before she got it right. You know, just the title, or not even right's the wrong word. Got something that sold. You
right.
know, that got something that the
yeah.
reviewers would you know, got excited about. So you will change stuff, and you'll send it back, and it's a whole new panel, and they come back, and they criticize you for the things that you changed from the first impression, right? So again, you know, thick skin, take both sets of reviews, think about whether this really is the right question, okay? Maybe you do need to take a step back. I have a thick folder of proposals that I submitted two or three times and realized that was just not going to sell at the time. Now, it turns out that at least one of those I think may sell now, and I'm thinking about pulling it back out again and trying it again. But it takes a thick skin, and it takes your critical evaluation of what people are telling you to retool your proposal and put it back out there.
So something else I heard from Stephanie Furman, who's done a number of these panels with us, is that when you get a proposal rejected, not to just throw it away, but to actually take that text that you used and make it into a paper and publish it. She said she's done that a few times, and it works, that you've got a paper to reference when you write your grant the next time.
That's right. If you already have written, you know.
At least for like a review paper or something like that. Yeah. I thought that was an interesting suggestion.
No. Yeah, certainly. In writing a proposal is a piece of scholarship. Right? I mean, you're proposing to do something that no one has ever done before, or you know, few people have done before, at any rate. And to do it in different ways for different reasons. So it ought to be unique. It ought to be a unique piece of work. And so I do agree that there might be something that could be publishable from that.
I have a question sort of along the lines. I'm usually, before I commit to an idea, I like to discuss it a lot with different people and see what's their approaches. And I actually been cautioned by a few senior people saying that never share your ideas before you publish, because it's going to get stolen and you never know who's going to hit you. And I'm now having a hard time because I want to share everything. But I feel like maybe if the senior people suggesting that I don't, I probably shouldn't, and I don't know how to find a balance and if you have any ideas on that.
That's really hard. And if you're in an area, you know, my perception of molecular biology is that's where, you know, this is just rampant, you know, people, I'm not going to discuss it with you. You know, I've always fallen on the side of being pretty open with the respect to the things that I'm working on. I think the reason is that if you're viewed as a person who has good ideas and is willing to share them, maybe you lose a couple. But I can't capitalize on all the ideas that I have. You know, that's not to say that I'm not bragging that I'm that productive, you know. But it's just, you know, I get a lot of ideas. I once heard H.T. Odum described. I don't know how many of you know H.T. Odum, one of the founders of the field of ecology, probably one of the most prolific PhD generators, you know, in the history of science. Eugene Odom was his brother. The two of them were just powerhouses in the development of the field of ecology. And H.T. Odom was described as having, 200 ideas a day, 199 of which were utter crap, you know. But one was brilliant, you know. And he shared these ideas. And I think that's the way I prefer to operate. But I do appreciate that as a younger person, if you've got what you think is a really, really good idea, that you don't want to necessarily go broadcasting that everywhere, but you should, hopefully, have mentors, people that you can trust who can guide you to think through that and perhaps suggest people who you could talk with further about that idea. It's an unfortunate fact that science is competitive. I mean, we submit proposals for a competition. You know, it is a competitive process, and the best ideas win out. And so, you want to hold on to a good idea and make sure you can capitalize on it. But I would like to think that we were open enough to share our ideas and get feedback from each other. I'm not sure that is a good answer for you, but it's. Best
but I
can
like
do.
It.
Okay.
So, I am working on an interdisciplinary degree with hydrology SFD, and I really like to collaborate with people, let's say permafrost and soil modeling and such. At the same time, as I very much enjoy to cross the disciplines, I feel like how far can I get learning these different languages without feeling that I'm losing the base, my main. Language, like what recommendation do you have to young interdisciplinary scientists in that regards?
You are asking the wrong person. I am a what's the adage about being? I'm very broad and shallow.
Jack of all trades,
master of none. Yeah, that was it. And maybe there is a larger message here, and that's that there's a book called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. There is no right way to conduct your life, either personally or professionally. There's no right way, no one way to do it. I think there are very few, probably no choices that you will come to in your life where there is clearly, this is the right thing I should do, this is the wrong thing I should do, other than robbing the liquor store or something like that, you know. I made a choice so I was working in coastal ecology. I was doing work in coastal ecology and coastal wetlands. And I had begun to make a name for myself. I had published some papers on nitrogen cycling in coastal wetlands. When I got an opportunity, serendipity, got a call from Herb Borman. I don't know how many people know him, who was the founder of the Hubbard Brook Ecosystem Study, very well known for his work in forest ecology. So I'm going to give up my work in wetlands ecology, and I'm now going to go work in forests. And I wondered, is that something that I should do? Well, I did. It introduced me to whole new ways of thinking, a whole new network of people. And I have personally found it gratifying and frustrating to be able to know a little bit about a lot of things. There is tremendous success, certainly, and I look at my own son, for example, and some of the things that he's doing. He's a neuroscientist, and he's been very, very, very focused on what he does from his undergraduate career right up through his PhD, and he's advancing very quickly. Certainly there's a lot to be said for being the recognized expert in a particular field. I don't know how many people we can sustain being the recognized expert, and the practical matter is that many of you will be looking for academic positions or administrative positions or whatever, where it is very valuable to know a little bit about many things, to be somebody who can interact with a number of different people on an interdisciplinary team. So if I was to, if I can summarize this long-winded thing, I think at least early on, you should try to be recognized for something that that you Anna contributes to the science, but be open then to the opportunities of diversifying what you do and working with others.
There's also a trend now to be to conduct studies across disciplines, and you know, including you know, physical, biological, and social science. So, especially with our realization that humans are really very much involved in everything, not just as observers, but actually as causes or and impacted by you know the things we do. So, so that's another way of looking at it. You know, be good in you know try and be good in your own field, but be ready. And actually, it's advantageous if you could work with other fields, because then you probably would get other insights that you wouldn't just from staying within your own.
One other follow-up question on the NSF stuff. You guys had said that Broader Impacts is, you know, getting more and more weight. I haven't even heard it's a 50-50 split anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a make or to break it. As a young researcher, I'm obviously not going to have grad students under me to mentor
right
at this point. My networks of outreach to other teachers and things like that, I'm establishing those. But for somebody who's young, what are the best Broader Impacts that you've seen in proposals and review panels and such?
Well, I'm just going to... You're at the Desert Research Institute, right? I imagine that the Desert Research Institute has connections of its own, right, to as an institute to various opportunities that might be broader impacts. I would be looking to leverage those opportunities rather than try to establish them yourself would be my first bit of advice. It used to be that it was sufficient, before Broader Impacts was really defined as something useful. It was, you know, oh, you'd go give a lecture to a seventh grade class someplace, and that was gonna fit. You know. Now I think there's much more substantive interactions with teachers, helping to form curricula. Working with environment and science and technology museums, where you can have a broader impact by looking at interacting with a clientele that walks into that museum. We got reasonable kudos, I think, in our reviews for the Thermokarst project. You guys should explain it. Yeah,
They were really good.
Yeah, so why don't you describe what we're doing there?
Well, I know for not just for career, you know, young early career scientists, but it used to be that when professors, assistant professor, associate professor would say, oh, I have a grad student, and that was their broader impact.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even that is not enough now. You have to say, how are you going to guide this person not only in doing science, in learning techniques on doing research, but also help in their career development, you know. So looking at it as holistically and saying, you know, it's just half of you is research, and the other one, you know, you're on your own, because, you know, whether you succeed in your relationships, in establishing networks, you know, that's on your own. But so that's now part of that. But taking on what Brett suggested, as a young, you may not be able to establish your own program, because also the amount of money that you have may not be as much as you'd like to divide between the science research part and the education outreach, but partnering with an already established program that could fit with your own particular science. So that's one of the things to start.
Yeah.
So part of the beauty of IPY is that it's making these opportunities and these ways for you to get involved very easily in education outreach activities easy. You send Brianne an email and you say, I want to do something. And she puts you in touch with a teacher. Polar Trek does the same thing. So a lot of the things that we're doing as well, as from APAC's point of view, is to help you, first of all, learn how to do that stuff. Because how do you, I don't know, I didn't know how to do education and outreach when I was a grad student. So it's a training process for you as well as a way to put these things together. And this panel right here counts as pretty good education and outreach for a grant proposal. And it's pretty easy. You send out an email and say, we're going to do this. And you pick some fun, nice, good scientists who are willing to come and help. And that's a really powerful, you know, education and outreach opportunity. Just some ideas, you know.
So when IPY ends, who do I send an email?
I just want to say, don't forget that that some of your institutions are members of fairly big organizations, AGU, AAAS. They belong to maybe if you're part of a museum or have something on your campus, there might be some affiliation there. ARCUS, we have most universities across the country are members of ARCUS, and there's ways that we've already built in ARCUS to send out information to other universities or to help them bring scientists together to have these workshops and things. So use what's at hand and kind of do a little bit of research. You might have to actually talk to your mentors or talk to senior researchers and see what they've used to outreach. And the other thing about the broader impacts is that I would say that you're not in a unique situation. Most of the senior scientists that submit proposals don't know how to do education and outreach either. They really struggle with the broader impacts all across the board. It's not you aren't unique being young. It also happens with senior scientists. And it's not just outreaching to a K-12 teacher or to a single classroom. Communities are very interested in what you're doing. If you're doing any environmental or climate change, there's probably an active organization within your own community that would like to learn more about that. There's Rotary Clubs, there's Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, there's all sorts of outside entities that are very interested in what's happening in our world. And you can just Google them if you aren't familiar with what's going on in your community to find out who some of those organizations are. Because sometimes those are easier to do presentations at and talk about what you're doing. Maybe you belong to a church, maybe you belong to some other kind of community affiliation.
I was just going to say it's a good question. One of the main parts of my job is to facilitate or encourage direct interaction between polar researchers and the public, be it artists or educators or media or, as you were saying, church groups or whatever. And I came into it as a scientist, and one thing that we discovered very quickly, which is something that Dave said earlier, is the teachers and the artists and the church groups, and they're actually all really, from the science side, we're saying, but how do I reach you? How do I meet you? What do I do? Just kind of walk into my local primary school and say, can I come and talk to your kids about climate change? It's a bit random to do that. Similarly, that all those networks and the teachers as well, they really are very receptive and would love to have a scientist come into their classroom, but again, they don't know how to make that happen. And it's actually sometimes, it is a bit weird, it feels a bit odd. Some people are really good at building up their local networks and connections, and some people would rather go as a representative of a group or as part of a program. So for instance, Polar Trek facilitates these great programs which bring together scientists and teachers, and then kind of almost gives it an okay for them to then develop their own relationships and communities. And Apex, I think, is another good kind of enabler of saying one of the things that Apex wants to do is to say, we are a network of young researchers and we're really interested in education outreach. And so it's sort of a network that teachers can then come to and say, okay, well, that's great. I live in this place. Do you know someone? And then you can have that connection made and somehow you've got a more... So one thing I'd say is that that's still being developed. I mean, Apex is still very young and it's only as good as its membership. So we've all got a lot of dreams, but if these are the things that you want to see happen, then it's. I guess this is an appeal. I'm on the Apex Education Outreach Committee. It's an appeal to say, if you... what I hadn't taken on before, which was interesting in your question, is that this could actually be something useful in your grant proposal writing, is to show how you've taken your research beyond. So it also becomes a career development aspect. And that's something we should do, and that's something that we can do. But I always do this little pitch that Apex doesn't do stuff and we are the recipients. We are Apex, so it's only as good as what we do. So if that's something that we should do, then we should do it, so let's do it. So if you're interested in that side of stuff, drop me an email and let's just do it, basically.
Is there a section on the Apex website on education and outreach and what are the different things that you can get involved in and get sort of a part of your grant proposal? Those are the sort of like some examples, for example, like this is what people have done before as part of their NSF grants and this is what we think is useful, or those are the contacts that say you have, or your email and say, like, I have contacts from people from, say, I don't know, state of California. If you live there, that would be a good thing for you to collaborate.
That's a good idea. There is a section on education outreach. It's not as specific as that because Apex is international, so it doesn't actually have a sort of NSF section or a US mm-hmm. section, but it could do. If there's enough of you here in the States who want to develop, that would be a really useful thing. And I think there's also a career development panel, and maybe that would be a useful thing in there. But like I said, I mean, these are ideas, and we're in the idea creation stage, and I think actually what would be useful, I haven't run this idea past Jenny at all as I'm making it up at this end of the room. But what would be useful, if there's a good idea that comes out of this meeting, is that actually somebody puts their hands up to say, well, I'll help you do that. And most of these things aren't that difficult. It's a couple of hours of work. Literally somebody writes it, somebody else edits it, somebody reads it, and then we pop it on the Apex website. But I think what Apex could really benefit from right now, Jenny's worked really, really hard to get it to where it's at, and the executive committee works very, very hard as well. But I think it needs more of a voice from the general membership doing the 2 hours a month rather than the 2 hours a day or full-time anyway. But there was also another plea I was going to say for an opportunity. If any of you are oceanographers or work in any kind of in science in any way related to oceans or aquatic research, we have a Polar Oceans Day. Every 3 months we do an IPY day, focuses on a different aspect of polar research. And in March, we're doing one focusing on polar oceans. And if any of you would like to get involved in that, this is an example of a really easy way to get involved in education outreach. We'll hook you up. You would just need to say it's a Polar Trek live event or something. We tell, you know, basically it's a question of send us your bio and turn up for an hour on the day on the internet and chat to some kids who would have arranged everything else for you, so... those are the kinds of opportunities I would say you should do to start with, just to get used to doing it. And then once you've done a few opportunities like that, working with programs that already exist, then start writing your own proposals for education outreach because you've got experience then of what works and what doesn't work and who you like working with.
Well, yeah, I just a couple of reflections on that, I suppose. One specifically, I don't know whether you've gone there, but on NSF's website, if you drill down far enough, you can get to a site that tells a page that tells you about what NSF thinks they're talking about when they talk about broader impacts. It's not terribly helpful, but you should read it if you
read it.
You should read it if you have it.
No.
The other comment that I want to make is that early on in this, so there was the intellectual merit and there was some broader impacts you had to do, but very early on in the history of this, you know, you put in your budget and it was all about the intellectual merit, and then, oh, I'll teach a graduate student, or, you know, as Elena was saying, or there was no money, there was no actual funding put in because to the broader impacts part of it, because it was viewed as being incorrectly, it was viewed by the PIs as being just something that kind of spontaneously generated out of the science that you were doing. And increasingly, it's become aware that you actually need to invest in that. Invest in it intellectually and invest in it monetarily. It needs to be a part of your project. Now, that has some problems. That means that if there's only this much money you can get, you may need to be doing some adjustments with respect to the science you think you can get done with this project, and then investing a bit, something, in being able to do the broader impacts. And the last thing I'm going to say is that I think you're hearing that this is more than just a hobby. Okay, it's not just something you do for goofs. And there are folks like Jenny and Elena and Rianne who are, this is a profession now. It is a professional discipline, really. And I recognized when we put our Thermocarst project together that I'm not the person to make that happen on our project. I don't have the skills and the capabilities to make that happen myself. I need to partner with someone who does know how to do that, and that's why we approached Jenny and Elena to become a part of this project. Now, that doesn't absolve me of responsibility. You know, just because I've tricked them to get to my proposal, that doesn't absolve me of responsibility from being involved. I need to now be substantively involved, so there is this technology transfer, if you will, that goes on between the science part of the project and the outreach part of the project.
One other area for a source of connecting with the education community from your institutions is, don't forget, many of you have a Department of Education as part of your university system. And so that there's teachers that are learning to become teachers called pre-service teachers, and they're often looking for people to come in and talk about science and to those teachers as they're going through their careers. And there's educators there that are really willing to try to help you also partner in on grants and things. So you may not have to go too far outside of your institution.
And the institution... Yeah, the institution you're at has exactly the same mandate. You know, they have to have outreach, so they ought to be falling over themselves to help you make these linkages.
I'm actually curious to hear from the international participants if these types of things are important for your proposals and things like that, too, because I think sometimes it's easy for us in the U.S. to just think that it only works the way NSF works. So is this a concern for when you write proposals and things, too?
They just hand you money. Now in Italy, it's not a nice period of time because, there are a lot of troubles for funding. We got a national program for Antarctic research. I was paid by that program last year while I was on ice. But, you have always got sometimes 3 years long a project, For 20 years, more or less, we are involved in studying the basement rocks in Antarctica. So, and also biology and oceanography, many stuff. We had a ship in Antarctica, everything. But what always comes out is sort of probably different. Some things are different in respect to the U.S. So there are probably it's not the same kind of form. And in that project, for example, in Angel, there was the educational and outreach effort for each nation brought at least one teacher. So there were primary school teacher or high school teachers, so very stage. And it was a very nice effort, but in many other proposals in at least in Italy, as far as I know, because I'm still a PhD student, so I have a long way to go. But we are not used to have educational and outreach efforts, at least on ice, or neither of ice, in the sense that usually there are academic people involved in projects and other national institutions involved, like geophysics institutions and other kind of institutions, but usually the educational and outreach is not as popular as in the U.S. So it's I think that one of the first, or probably the first project was that Android project. So both the first drilling season, the 2006, and last drilling season, the 2007, were the first, let's say, educational and outreach in, you know, by the Italian side effort. So it's still something that is not as popular. But, you know, there are, for example, the, I don't know if you know him, but the last teacher of the first drilling season, Matteo Cattadori, made a poster at the EGU. It was, I think that also this year, it was allowed by his his city hall to have the one day off from teaching for dealing with the education and outreach on this Android project. So it was very nice, but it's probably the first case. So it's, we are not used to it. Maybe a way of getting people more involved and knowing about science and polar science, because there are many people, unfortunately, that don't know which things are going on. Even if, you know, Italy has not a long-lived Antarctic program, but it's a 23-year-old program, so it's not a 5-year program. So it's, you know, a lot of things to do. May have been and may be done with also the educational and outreach help, let's say.
Eleanor, that's fantastic. Makes a really good point, actually. I just want to build on that with the international perspective. What you said about it's new and Matteo is your first teacher, and a good point that even the teachers aren't getting time off to develop this material and the scientists aren't getting the time to develop it. So a lot of these activities start as volunteer efforts with people doing it really, you know, because they believe it's an important thing. But what I was just thinking when you were saying that, Matteo definitely is one of the first in Italy. In Portugal, there's been a huge polar outreach program connecting scientists to schools. Every single school in the national sort of state-funded network has had a polar science program in it, and that was instigated by young researchers from APEX in Portugal. And now it's nationally funded because it was seen as such a success. In New Zealand, the New Zealand government didn't have any money for IPY at all. All the people who wanted to do an education program or outreach program said, we haven't got any funding, so we can't do anything. And the young researchers in APEX in New Zealand said, sod that. I'm sorry, we're used to living off no money. And they went and they developed a national polar contest program where all the schools around New Zealand had a grad student come into their classroom and develop essentially a classroom activity around a polar theme. But it was had the science was great because the students there. It was great outreach experience for the grad student. It was great contact experience for the school students. And then, a year and a half into IPY, or maybe I'm exaggerating, 1 year into IPY, the New Zealand government, that we don't have any officials in here, we do, the New Zealand government flew the Prime Minister of New Zealand to Antarctica, and weirdly enough, 2 weeks later, they had $11 million given to IPY. And suddenly they said, and we have to do outreach. Where are your proposals? And the only people who've done anything was the young polar researchers, and so they got funded. In Germany, I could give you a similar story. In France, Hugues and the permafrost. Anyway, the point is that actually some of these efforts, all of these efforts, in fact, especially in IPY, have been championed by the APEX polar researchers in countries all around the world who said, we have to get out there, we have to get into the schools, even if it's not funded, and we don't have a formal program. And now, the fact that APEX is formally recognized and exists makes it a hell of a lot easier, because at that time it was still really hard to, it was difficult. It was just a lot of students saying, we're going to do it. And they said, who are you? And they said, well, we're just us. And now everybody knows who APEX is, and you can actually do a lot in the name of APEX, even though, like I said, we are, you know, we're as strong as. So I guess the point there being is if there's a program that you think is a good idea, you can do it in the name of APEX. And actually at the moment, things like that are getting funded, because and we have a track record. And if any of you, if that helps for any of your proposals, I can easily write you a couple of paragraphs that says how the ball has got rolling in at least 10 other countries as a result of APEX activities.
Yeah, that brings up one thing that comes to mind when you say that is my university, someone developed a suitcase.
Oh, are you in Alabama?
Oh, science. But and so maybe it takes it's in many places, but just these suitcase lessons where you don't really have to develop the lessons yourself, but they're available for you just to take and go to the classrooms and something like that for full design.
There's actually quite a few of those things. Yeah. Andro has some amazing products that you can just, and they're easy. And so stop by the Andro booth or email me and I'll put you in touch with Louise. They're great.
And the IPY holidays, even though they're every 3 months, exist from all the past days, so we've got activities there.
And Polar Trek also has a learning resources section.
And we're Apex, some of them are one of my favorite members in Belgium had an idea of creating a resource book for teachers and young scientists with activities in there. We're still in the development phase, so if anybody wants to get involved, please let us know. The first half is the first part of it is basic introduction to polar science for people to pick up and learn about. You know, whether you're a scientist or not doesn't matter. The second part is all these quick, easy activities you can just take into a classroom and use, or teachers can use in the classroom. And the third part is tips and tricks for young researchers, well, not just young researchers, any scientist.
Right.
You know, when you go into a class of, you know, six-year-olds, do they understand when you say what 100 feet means? You know, different things like this, as well as just ways to engage students and things like that. And so Kristen and Janet and I and Louise and Rhianna and Elena are all working on that. And so, you know, even if you have tips that you've learned, you know, please send them to us. We'd really like to help, but that book will hopefully help in some of those areas as well.
Yeah, and I'm just going to sign in for Apex. I'm already thinking of it. And I'm like, oh, we got a discussion forum, and I see the link, but no one's posted anything. So we can post some of these links and things that will directly to Apex. But just so you'll also know, the National Science Foundation is also they've working with Louise and some others to redo some books that they have. One is to redo an Antarctic book. It's classroom activities that focus on Antarctica. And then they're also creating one about the Arctic. And it's got a lot of recipe-like classroom activities and information about the Arctic and the Antarctic. It will be available. I think the Arctic one isn't done, but the Antarctic one.
I also hear that the Antarctic one has an amazing chapter on the McMurdo Five Valleys.
Yeah. It's really good. They're actually really good. I just say to that point as well, there are hundreds of resources out there, and I work in the IPY office and I still don't know where most of the resources are. There are, and it's a problem. It's a problem that we recognise, and it's a problem that is really a problem for teachers as well. I would actually say for polar scientists, if you're interested in outreach, if you're interested in working with students, the best thing you can do, and whether it's through an organized program or through local networks or through your sister-in-law who happens to be a teacher, get into a classroom and don't worry too much about what you're going to do there. Let the teacher worry about that because they're the professional and they know what they want is you to be in that classroom showing your woolly hat that you wore in Antarctica and your big boots, and the kids will go wild. And actually, if you say to the teacher, the first time I went into a school was through a neighbour, through my mum's neighbour, and I was meant to be the education outreach person. I really actually had done very little, and I was terrified. Not the first time in a school, the first time in primary school. I'd been in high school quite a lot. I was terrified. I was like 6-year-olds. Oh my god! And I said that to the teacher. I said, look, I've never been into a primary school before, and I really don't know. And they were great, and they were really helpful. And so I guess my point about resources, there are thousands out there, but actually, I don't think we should be stressing too much about that. I think just getting it into some schools and getting some experience and getting the buzz from hanging out with kids and then seeing what comes out of that.
We have been once in Sigachuk in this small village, and all we did was we brought map with us, Arctic map, and asked the children to show where they are and where we come from. This is it. And 45 minutes, extremely interesting children faces out poking into the polar and asking us a terrific question about why there's ice, why they're so apart, and where the Greenland is. The resources could be limited as, I don't know, book you have in your packet or map that you have. Just come in as you are, and children like to pick your brain.
believe me, and they're curious so that they're going to be this unstoppable and asking you why, what, and where. And you're going to be so tired of this question. You're going to be like looking at the door and saying, please, can I leave now?
Actually, I taught fourth grade, and the one thing that we did was we used to follow the Iditarod. And so the students would each get to pull the name out of a hat of somebody who was doing the Iditarod and follow them. But the major lack was that there was really no connection to actual science or any kind of tangible reason why or what was happening in the Arctic at all. So there was a big gap. So I think I can speak pretty sincerely to the fact that as a teacher, filling that gap is just desperately needed and wanted. Like I don't know, somebody said it earlier that I think Dave did that, the drive to have information about global climate change and actually have a scientist in your room explaining why this is happening or why maybe it's not going to happen soon is totally important. And they love it. Students love it. It's just like you said that with the hat and the boots and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Even just having a scientist say, yes, it's true.
Yes.
I've had a lot of teachers and students, for that matter, you know, go to a class of 16-year-olds. They've all heard about climate change and studied it, but hearing somebody who says, yeah, you know, actually, this is what, not it's true, but, you know, they'd say, or to say, what, you know, like someone said to me the other day, is the global warming, is that a problem with the ozone hole? And I was like, oh, you're not. but it's important to just, you don't need to know everything. You just need to say, well, this isn't my area of expertise, but this is what I do know, this is what I don't know.
And the other part that just to tag on that is, like, to be able to actually say this is science. There's a major problem, especially in American schools, that people don't, they see science and they think of, like, test tubes and, you know, science. And they don't really know that actually what you're doing out there on an ice sheet is actually considered science. So you actually end up sparking a whole new generation of interest in science because, oh, wait, I can go out there and hang out. Oh, right. And, yes, it's science.
So I hate to do this. We've got about 15 minutes left. And Mary Beth Murray is here, and she's the director of the International Study on Arctic Change and has a, I think, hopefully an interesting opportunity that might be coming up that she wanted to mention.
Yeah, I can mention that briefly. Our program is a new program that was developed by the, initiated by the International Arctic Science Committee and the Arctic Ocean Sciences Board. And basically, it's a science program we're trying to develop international collaboration in Arctic environmental change research. So building on the CERT program, which started in the U.S., which I think some of you are probably familiar with, and then the European Union, this big funded effort under Damocles, and now partnering with Canada and the ArcNet program there to develop sort of a coordinated vision of how to do science and what are the pressing science issues in the Arctic over the next decade. And we're an open-ended program, although, like you guys, we don't really have a lot of money. But one of the activities that one of the things that I'm trying to get going over the next year is an opportunity for an intern in our project office, which is currently located in Stockholm. And I'm having sometime in the new year some discussions with Canada about maybe providing some funding for that. And the way that we being me, because I am the project office, have kind of envisioned this is for a new PhD or somebody at the postdoc level that can come in to the science office and start to work in that milieu of international coordination activities and speak on behalf of the program and travel out and present the science plan and possibly even rotate through some of the different office project offices for the big programs that contribute to us, like the CERT project office or Damocles, although that's winding down. So it's still pretty nascent, but that is something that we're trying to generate some funding for. And ultimately, I would like to see that as a permanent part of the program where someone can come in who's got an active science program but wants to get more involved in the international piece of that and work at that level. So that's a, you know, on the paper, and I will be sort of communicating with Jenny about that over the next year or so that if we can get it going, she can send it out and then we'll have some kind of a burst of it. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we can get some money.
as like reasonable salary, not slave wages.
Those types of opportunities are pretty amazing. They might look a little daunting, and you might think, oh, I got to take a year off of my research, but the number of contacts and people that you meet through that is quite amazing. And I can say that from the Apex stuff that I've been doing and different things like that, and I know there's other in the room that have had those experiences. It's amazing. You can be in a completely different field with somebody, but you get to know them on a different level, and they start stimulating your other ideas, and they start thinking in different ways. So I encourage all of you to keep your eye out for those types of activities.
And one comment that I would make about that, because I still have an active research program, even though I'm the executive director of this program, and I would like to develop an internship program that would allow somebody to still, I mean, so that they're not going to be behind the eight ball if they want to go back into the research they need. So I think that at least as long as I'm in the office, I would sort of work for that sort of flexibility for people, because I realize that it is a bit of a scary option after you finish a PhD and to sort of go into something a little bit not so research oriented if you're not quite clear about what you want to do. So I'd like to try and keep some flexibility to the extent that it's possible.
The other thing I want to make sure everybody knows about is the ice party tonight at the Exploratorium. There are flyers, I think, Elisa.
There's some.
Make sure you grab one. There's a bus that's leaving at the Moscone's, from the Moscone Center at 6:15 that'll take you over to the Exploratorium. And there's a lecture first, and then from 8 to 10, it's a
party.
lots of really good food and beverages as well.
You don't have to go to the lecture to get to the party. They actually made that very clear. The lecture, it's a public lecture, and the party for anyone to do anything with IPY is very welcome.
And they did that last year. And I know Chris, you were there, and it was a lot
of
fun.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
it was
crazy.
I don't want to promise that because I have no idea.
Yeah,
this one.
It'd be great if all of us can go and continue these types of discussions and things like that. Bring your friends; it's free. And I would like to really thank Rick and Elena and all of you for coming today. I hope this was useful. I would like to hear your feedback if this was useful or if anything that we talked about today was something that you'd like to get involved with more or like to hear more about. Please just drop me a line and let me know. There's Apex postcards up there with my email address. Yep, Rosemary.
I'd just like to say something to everyone, really. I've just been in contact with something like the Green Schools program at my university, so I'm going to be putting together some sort of short basic presentation for people to use if they want to go into schools. So if anyone else here is going to do that, let's do it together. It doesn't have to be English speaking people. I'll be writing it in English. We can translate whatever you like. So my email address will be on this list somewhere. I've got business cards as well if people want them. So just let me know, just to let you know that's what I'm doing.
And if anybody wants to just have more of a chat about anything we've discussed, Jenny and I and Dave also will be at the IPY booth, which is, if you go into Moscone West and go into the exhibit area, just try to go straight on. You won't be able to because you have to dodge some booths, but if you just went straight on, you'd hit us. So come and chat. We'll be there all day today.
It's right next to NSF's Office of Polar Programs.
Yeah.
There you
might
go.
Be able to introduce you to people.
I just had one thing. If you have any opportunity if you're asked to be a reviewer of even a student grant, competition, or as much as you can, volunteer for that, because then you get ideas of actually how you would be, judging in qualities of research papers. And the same way, jump at opportunities to gain experience in something that you don't have any, but would be part of your career. So again, being open to those opportunities.
Any final words?
No final words of wisdom.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Jenny.